Even if the day is not burned into your memory from the shock of seeing it unfold on the news, you still know, or most of you here know, about 9/11 from the subsequent memorials and reminders. The sudden transformation of two huge buildings into piles of rubble and ash was devastating. While certainly not on the same scale as 9/11 from the sense of the size and scope of it, these pictures should help us understand how David felt when he went back to Ziklag to find the city burned and all his people taken away by the Amalekites. Look, if you will, just a couple of pages over in your Bible, 1 Samuel chapter 30. In 1 Samuel chapter 30, in verses 1 through 3, David has been with the Philistines and is sent away because they're getting ready to go to war against the Israelites, and they don't want him with them because they don't know whose side he'll fight on. And in chapter 30, verses 1 through 3, he returns to his home that had been given to him by the Philistines, and he discovers it a burned-out wreck. Verse 1, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites, the very same ones that Saul was supposed to wipe out, had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. So he walked in, or they rode back into a devastated place like this. I mean, again, not the same scale, but very similar. Just think of it, if you go to your house and it's burned to the ground, and you obviously weren't prepared for it, it's going to be a shock. So imagine all of them coming home. There's David and his 600 men, and then there's no telling how many other people might have been around there with them that had been part of that. And all of their families were gone. And so when you take David's 600 men, that means there were probably twice that many women and children, maybe even three times that many women and children, that had been carried off into captivity by the Amalekites. And so they were devastated by this. If you remember, he had spent a decade of his life running for his life, and they had settled in this place, Ziklag, for the last 16 months and had made it their home. And they had thought this was a time for some peace and some form of safety, at least, for his family. This man, who had been anointed by God to be the next king of Israel as a young teenager, 15, 16 years old, spent the key years of his young life running and hiding, and finally thought for a few moments that he had a brief bit of safety, just to come back and find devastation and heartbreak once again. I want that to sink in. I want us to think about what it was like for David to come home to his home and find it destroyed, and his family and the families of all his men carried off into captivity. No wonder they all sat down and wept. Look at verse 4 of chapter 30. Then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. They had nothing left. They were just exhausted in despair and sorrow, much like many of the people on 9/11. And if you follow the process after 9/11, the cleanup and rebuilding of this site took some time, and the replacement was not opened until 10 years ago, actually, in November of 2024 or 2014. And again, it helps us to realize that despite their successful recovery of all their family and possessions, along with all the other spoil taken by the Amalekites, remember we talked about that last time, they came back to a burned-out city. They came home, the city had not been miraculously rebuilt, so they were camping out and sleeping out in the outside because their homes had been burned down. And then 3 days later, news came of the death of Saul and his best friend Jonathan, which took David down to the ground in sorrow once again. Look in 2 Samuel now in chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag, On the third day, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, from where do you come? And he said, I escaped from the camp of Israel. How did things go? David said, how do you know? Then he finds out that Saul is dead. His son Jonathan is dead. In verse 11, then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did also his men who were with him, and they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. This an emotional roller coaster. Safety. Well, Philistines don't touch me. I go home. My house is burned down. Our village is burned down. Our families are carried off. We are able to go and rescue them. We bring them back. So we're, all right, well, there's a mess here. We've got to clean up and rebuild. And then 2 days later, 3 days later, you find out that your best friend has been killed in battle and the Israelites have been defeated by the Philistines. I think sometimes we forget the things that David went through even in his younger, even in these days when it seems like everything sort of should be looking up for him. I mean, after all, he's supposed to be the king. Now he's free from the fear of Saul, but his best friend is dead. And Israel has been shamed. So for the survivors of the 9/11 and their families and friends, when they found out that their family that had been missing was alive and well, there was hope and joy even amid the sorrow. And in the same way, David would have felt that kind of hope and joy in the middle of his sorrow. Now that Saul was dead and his friend Jonathan was dead, but now there's a chance for him to step up and become king and become the king that God had chosen for him, had selected him to be. The path to the throne was finally open. Or was it? Well, yes and no. No, in that it didn't happen as soon as David would have hoped, because it took another 7.5 years before David became king of all Israel. But eventually it came to fruition. And so tonight, as we continue our series, David, a Better Man, we're going to look at it from the standpoint of the section I've called Forging a Kingdom. And we're going to look at 2 Samuel chapter 1 through 10. 2 Samuel 1 through 10. And just like last week, there's just so much here to cover, just too much to cover in any kind of detail. So we're going to look at it in five parts. We're just going to look at five sections that we're going to pull out and some ideas that we're going to pull out from the text to get us an idea of the life of David and some of the good things about him. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the bad things that David did and the mistakes that he made. They're many and they're real and they're serious, and we'll have to talk about them some. But just, we're trying to get a picture and a flavor of David, you know, that we don't always look at. There are certain parts of his life that we look at. Obviously, Goliath, and then running from Saul, and then the promise of God that his son would be God's son and establishing the kingdom, and David and Bathsheba. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that goes on around those that I think it's valuable for us to spend some time looking at it. So let's do that tonight. What we're going to look at is David is crowned in Hebron. That's first thing we're going to look at. Then the civil war that took place between Judah and Israel. And then the crimes and punishment, a section I call crimes and punishment. And then capturing a capital. And then finally, a conquering king. We see David really stepping up and taking over and building a kingdom. And that's why we call it forging a kingdom. Let's talk about being crowned in Hebron. That's in chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. And there's just a few things in this text. Let's read verses 1 through 7, and then we'll talk about a few things from the text. Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. So David said, where shall I go up? And he said, to Hebron. So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. We talked about her before. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. Then the men of Judah came and there anointed David king over the house of David. And they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul. David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. Now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I also will show this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Now, a couple of things that we want to look at in this text. First of all, is I want you to notice how David has changed a little bit, or maybe reverted is a better word here. In his days of running and hiding, he seemed to kind of lose his way, and many periods of time without contacting and reaching out to and following God and seeking God's will. Remember how we talked about one of the first things he did when he was realized that Saul was going to try to kill him no matter what, and he flees and he goes to Nob where the high priest is, or Abiathar the high priest is, or Ahimelech the high priest is, and then lies about why he's there, and then builds on the lie to get food and a sword from him. And then as a result of that, over 80 priests are killed, and then the city is ransacked and destroyed because of David's lie and getting them involved supposedly by Saul's accusation of helping David. So he's lied. Then he goes and hides with the Philistines and has to act like a drooling fool. And all of these are in 1 Samuel chapters 21 and 22. And then we have the period where he nearly murders the whole family of Nabal. And that's where Abigail came in and rescued her family and saved David from that atrocity before finally settling down with the Philistines. And that didn't work out very well because, as we've seen, he had to pretend to go raid the cities of Israel to keep the Philistines happy with him. And so he had to go out and be a plunderer himself, going into other towns and cities and plundering them. David, and then coming back and lying to Achish, the king of Gath, and saying, "Now I've been killing Israelites." So in this time frame where David's running and hiding, he's becoming quite a convincing liar. I think sometimes we just don't see that happening. And so there are some problems with David there. But now, I want you to notice back again in verse 1 of chapter 2, it seems like he's changed his heart a little bit. He's realized, I've got to turn back to God. I've got to go back to God. Notice in verse 1, he says, David inquired of the Lord. So now he's saying, all right, I have to find out what God... And actually, that really started there when he came back to Ziklag just a few days earlier, We don't know how long a time frame this is, but just a little bit earlier when he came back and I've hit bottom. Everything's at the bottom. There's nowhere to go but up. And so in chapter 30, that's when he said, when I want you to notice back in chapter 30 of 1 Samuel, says that in verse, at the end of verse 6, "But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, priest, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I pursue this man? Shall I overtake them?' And he said to him, 'Pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all.'" And so finally, David is reverting back to the kind of person he should have been all along, which is seeking God's will, trying to find out what God wants him to do, and then doing that instead of just doing whatever he thinks will keep him alive for the next 24 hours. And so David has a renewed desire to hear God. And so he asked, "Where do I go?" So he asked God first, where to go. Not only does he say, "Should I go up?" He asked that first. And then when God says yes, and the implicit idea is he's going to go up and become king, step into his role as king. And so then he says, well, where should I go? See how David is pursuing specific information from God. He's not wanting just general directions or approval. He's wanting to find out what God wants him to do. So he's thinking ahead. He's asking God before acting, before doing whatever it is that he thinks he needs to do. And so God sends him up there, and he goes up, and he's anointed as king over Judah. Notice again, this is just Judah. This is not all of Israel. And verse 4 says, "Then the men of Judah came up and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. That's in Hebron. So now he is anointed king over Judah. And I want you to notice also how he shows a much better character than Saul. Because he reaches out to the men of Jabesh-Gilead who are not under his jurisdiction. They're part of the nation of Israel. They're probably from the tribe of Gad. They're over on the east side of the Jordan River. They're not part of the Judah at all. And David reaches out to them and congratulates them and praises them and offers to and recognizes what they have done. Because they have all helped. They were the ones who went and recovered the bodies of Saul and Jonathan where they were nailed to a wall in the city, which they had to fight to get to. They didn't just walk in and say, hey, we'll take those. They had to kill people and risk their own lives and possibly even lose some lives there to do that. And so David recognizes this, even though he says, I'm king of Judah now. You're not, but way to go, guys. Way to go. So he praised them, showing a much better character. But then that leads us to the second point, and that is civil war. The civil war between Judah and the nation of Israel. When Saul's general, Abner, who was also Saul's first cousin, quickly seized control of the army there in 2 Samuel 2, verse 8, and made Saul's surviving son, Ish-bosheth, which is an interesting name, son of shame. And so there's no explanation of why Ish-bosheth didn't die like Jonathan and the other sons in the battle. Maybe he didn't even go. Maybe we don't know. So that would be all the speculation. But he's out of the picture, out of the battle, and now Abner comes along, and it shows he doesn't have the character to become king on his own. Abner makes him king. Verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even over all Israel. And so he took them over on the east side of the Jordan again. You had the west side, which is where Jerusalem and where they had been living, but they had to go over to the east side. And so you've got the king, you have Ish-bosheth made king, and his throne is set up over there because they basically ceded most of the control to the Philistines. You've got David down in Judah. You've got all the rest of the tribes now subjecting themselves to Abner and to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son. And it's just a mess, except for David is beginning to build a coalition and a group down in Hebron and demonstrating why God made him powerful, made him king, and demonstrating the administrative power and abilities that Saul just never seemed to have. So there's a war between them. And then during this war, Abner is actually the power behind the throne. He sets him up as king, and it's just kind of the power behind the throne. And there's a lot of stuff here in this text that we can look at. So I want to notice a couple things. Beginning in verse 12, Abner, Ish-bosheth's not involved in this. He's not there. Abner brings a bunch of men over to the west side of the Jordan to basically try to see who's going to have control over that side of the land. In contrast and in battle against David. And so they meet up with Joab. And this is the story where they meet at the pool and they're sitting on both sides of this pool of water. And Abner and Joab say, well, let the young men fight. That's the way wars usually are. Is young men go out and they kill each other. And so they go out and these 12 guys come out from each side and each one of them kills the other one. And as a result of that, a war becomes inevitable. Civil war now is going to take place, and for several years, for about 7 years, there is a fight between Judah and Israel, civil war between them. And at the end of this, in chapter 3, in verse 1, it says this, now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. So David was demonstrating not only that God was with him, but he was again seeking God's will in what he was doing. And so he became more powerful and more successful. And eventually there's conflict between Abner and Ish-bosheth. Because, again, Abner's the power behind the throne. And Abner decides to go down to David and say, you know what, David? You're the one that's supposed to be king over all Israel. Now, I want you to think about that. Abner's not a good guy in this story. He really isn't. Because it's obvious that he's trying to gain more power over Ishbosheth but is not willing yet to just take over completely. And he's confronted and insulted by Ishbosheth for what he's doing. And so he gets mad about it. He says, "All right, I'm just going to take the whole nation and give them to David," because he's supposed to be king anyway. Abner knew that David was supposed to be king, so there was no reason he should have been involved in setting up a rival kingdom and creating the civil war in the process. But there's a lot more to that story, and we won't take our time up with all of that. So let's jump to the next point, crimes and punishment. And I use the word crimes and punishment because there are multiple crimes, and we're not going to be able, again, to look at all of them. In the first battle, we talked about this battle where Abner and Joab have the men fight against each other, and then there's a fight that starts as a result of that battle, and the Israelites end up fleeing across the Jordan River as they're being chased by Joab and Judah. And in the process of that chase, Abner's being chased by Joab's brother, who is apparently, according to the text, very fast. He's a fleet-footed young man, and so he's chasing Abner. And they're fleeing as fast as they can to get away. And Abner has kept pleading with him, turn aside, don't follow me, go after some of the young men. And finally stops and kills Joab's brother in battle. And Joab has not let that go. And now he has a chance when he finds out that Abner's on their side of the Jordan and is available and he has access to him. And David's trying to broker a peace with them that brings all Israel to David. And Joab sends a messenger, calls him back, pretending to be welcoming him, and stabs him and murders him in cold blood when kind of like under a white flag truce kind of thing, just murdered him in cold blood. Joab is one of those guys that's going to make sure things get done. He's one that's going to know where the bodies are buried because he's going to be the one that buried many of them there. He's that kind of guy. But by the way, he is David's nephew. His mother is David's sister. But anyway, so that's their connection. It was an egregious sin, a murder in cold blood. And it's interesting how David responds to this. David responds by praising Abner and having a funeral ceremony honoring Abner and repudiating Joab. Look in chapter 3 and verse 28. In chapter 3, verse 28, it says this: "Afterward, when David heard of it," so David wasn't the one who planned or had him do this, because David's idea was, hey, if Abner can bring everybody in and I get control without having to kill any more people, everything will be great. That'll make things a lot more simple. "So afterward, when David heard it, he said, 'I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and on all his father's house.'" And then he goes to give this interesting curse. "May his family suffer all of these things." Verse 30, "So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon." And so there's your first crime. And the punishment is the curse. Now, David doesn't do anything to Joab until nearly 40 years later, when he has his son Solomon kill him because of this, specifically because of this murder. The crime, the punishment was delayed, but the crime was eventually punished. And here's one of the reasons why David didn't want this to unfold this way. Because as a result, the nation was still divided. Ishbosheth was still king. The Israelites had not been handed over to David yet. And so a couple of Ishbosheth's men decided, you know what, we'll kill Ishbosheth and David will reward us. So there'll be more bloodshed and David will be happy with us. Look there in chapter 3 and 4. This is the murder of this. And so when they come to him, they bring him in verse 8. "Then they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, 'Behold, the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. Thus the Lord has given my lord the king vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants.'" They didn't understand David. David didn't want to get revenge. He had promised Saul, and he promised Jonathan to protect their families. And later, we won't have the time, but later he finds a son of Jonathan and brings him back and provides for him and cares for him like one of his own. So they bring him the head. They think David's going to reward them because now, hey, we've settled the civil war problem for you. No, you just committed murder. Verse 9. David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized and him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood from your hand to destroy you from the earth? And so you see a little bit of the nature and character of David. He wants to try to keep peace, and he doesn't really like to kill people, though he's very good at it. He'd rather have peace. But these men have brought their own execution upon themselves by this evil sin. And so you have that crime and punishment. And we could take time, and we won't do so, but when he brought the ark into Jerusalem, or tried to bring the ark into Jerusalem, and they were carrying it on a cart, and Uzzah reached out in disobedience to the will of God and touched the ark, because Uzzah should have known, as a priest, he should have known it doesn't belong in an ark, in a cart. God said the priests were to carry it on poles, and he should have known better, and he didn't. And later, when they finally bring it in, they carried on poles. But here, they're disobeying God, even though they're trying to honor God. David's excited. You read the text about this. David's excited. He's brought everybody into it. In Corinthians, Chronicles talks about this. First Chronicles talks about this. David's excited. He's got all Israel together and coming into Jerusalem to come with them to celebrate bringing the ark into Israel, into Jerusalem. And Uzzah's riding, walking along by the cart, and reaches out and touches it to steady it, and God strikes him dead. Talk about putting a damper on a party. That celebration goes south fast. Crimes and punishment. And then, of course, there's in chapter 11 and following, which we won't talk about really in this study or any of these, where David's sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah that ends with basically God saying, sword's never going to depart your house, David. A son, you know, three sons die as a result of this sin. Not just the child of Bathsheba, but also his oldest son, and then his beloved Absalom, all because of crime. Crime brings punishment. There's always a punishment that's going to come. It may not be quick, swift, it may not seem fair, but crime will be punished. Well, the next thing is we will look at is capturing a capital. And this comes after all Israel came to David in Hebron and made it, anointed him king. That's in chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. Now Ishbosheth's dead, and all Israel comes to David and says, God said you're supposed to be our king anyway, so now it's time for you to become our king. But he's in Hebron, which is way down in the south. You know, it would be like saying, you know what, let's make Franklin, Kentucky, the capital of Kentucky. Doesn't make much sense, does it? You know, Lexington's kind of right in the middle. Makes much more sense. And the same thing with David. His capital of the nation is way down in the south part. And so he says, all right, we'll find a city that's kind of on the border between the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, and more in the centrally located, so people will have access to it. And so he goes after and captures Jerusalem. That's in chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. Now the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, and they said to David, you shall not come in here, but the blind and lame will turn you away, thinking David cannot enter here. And it's a very short description of this process, and Chronicles is pretty close to the same brevity. And what they're saying is, our city is so secure, the lame and blind can keep you out. And if you remember from our classes, class studies on Wednesday nights, I've shown pictures of the artistic renderings of what Jerusalem looked like at the time when David would have captured it. And it was on a hill surrounded by steep valleys on three sides. And so it would have been very difficult to take. Verse 7, nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And notice how David kind of mockingly responds to their jibe. David said on that day, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul through the water tunnel. He said, all right, there's a way. Go up through the water tunnel. Therefore, they say, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house. And then David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all around from the Millo and inward. So David took the city and made it his capital, made it the central city. Same place that is today, Jerusalem, that is celebrated and thought and so honored by so many today. Well, anyway, David now has his capital. Let's go to the last thing, conquering kingdom. And we'll do this very quickly. Conquering king. We'll read this beginning in chapter 5, verse 17. He has two battles with the Philistines, defeats them soundly at God's direction. Remember, again, he's asking God, how do I do this? And God's telling him what to do. Then verse chapter 6 has the moving of the ark, but then after that, just a record of their continuing triumphs. Chapter 8, if you have one of the Bible that has headings in it, chapter 8 will probably say David's triumphs as he defeats all these armies. He conquers the Philistines, the Moabites, the Zoabites, the Arameans. Arameans, remember, are Syria that we've been talking about in our Wednesday night Bible class. The Edomites and the Ammonites. All of those become subject to David. I got this map I wanted to show you. David's kingdom, the extent of his kingdom, forging a kingdom. So by the time he had been king 20 years, he was basically ruling over all of this territory from the brook of Egypt, which is the divider between them and Sinai. So this is the border that God had promised. All of this here on the east side is just bonus land. It was not part of the promise in the first place. And then all the way up to the Euphrates River. All of this was under David's control. He exercised power. And then Solomon comes into power and it expands all that. Expands on all that. So David is now a conquering king. He has forged the kingdom that God had promised him, that God had promised Israel. And now the kingdom that God had made him king over when he was a 15, 16-year-old boy is under his control. And by this time, he's in his early 40s. So it's been taking a while, but now it's his. Well, there we have all of these events. We have him now conquering and forging a kingdom. And let's wrap up with some takeaways. And then the lesson will be yours. Some takeaways. First thing is, serve God. Then the kind of theme through all this is that David was a servant of God. First thing is, serve obediently. Do God's will, not ours. You saw how David would get in trouble when he would do things his way. But then when he would go to God and seek God's will, how things would go well for him. God would prosper him because he was wanting to do what God said. So if we're going to be servants like David, we're going to be like David, we need to serve obediently. But not only do we serve obediently, we need to serve humbly. One of the things you see throughout this is David's humility before God. And if we're going to serve God like David, we need to serve humbly. And so seek God's glory, not our own. Second thing is we need to serve patiently. Remember, he had over a dozen years where he's just running for his life. And then now Saul's dead. Now I can become king of Israel. Abner, Ishbosheth. Okay, now I'm just king of Judah for another 7 years before the nation is united. Patiently. God does not work on our time schedule. We're a microwave generation. There is not a single person in this building that does not have a microwave in their house. Raise your hand if I'm lying, if I'm wrong. There's not a single person. And so what we're used to is everything just being instant. David had to wait, and he had to wait. And so people and I think we forget what it's like to have to wait and be patient. God's patient with us. And so we need to be patient with God and not expect Him to operate on our time schedule. And then the last thing is serve penitently. When David messed up, and especially we didn't talk about it tonight, but with Bathsheba and Uriah, when he was confronted for his sin, unlike Saul, and this is where the big difference was between David and Saul. When God confronted Saul through Samuel for his sin, Saul was always making excuses. It's not my fault. I did God's will. It's their fault. It's the people's fault. It's everybody else's fault. It was never his. When David was confronted with his sin, it was always, I have sinned against God and against these people. David admitted his sin. If we're going to have a heart after God like David, then we have to be penitent people because God forgives when we repent. Well, those are your takeaways. Let's wrap up. Go ahead and get your songbooks out. And let's wrap up with just a couple of thoughts here as we conclude. We didn't talk about it tonight. We're going to talk about this next Sunday night, about the promise of a son in 2 Samuel chapter 7. So if you want to read ahead for next week, 2 Samuel chapter 7, the promise of a son that would be God's son. And that son of God would reign forever. And so the question is that this king who will be Jesus, who reigns now on his throne in heaven, where God said, promised his throne would be, David reigns there. He is king. And he calls on all of us to submit to him, to serve him. And so as we conclude tonight, the question is, does King Jesus reign in you? If not, how can we help you? Let him do that. If you need our help in any way to be right with God, we beg you. Please come while we stand, while we sing.